Hey, everybody. Thank you all for coming. My name is Dave, founder and CEO of Mog.com, and we're here today to talk about the future of online radio. So for the next hour, we're going to dive deep, really try to focus on where perspective, and then also get into a little bit, but hopefully not too much, kind of the economics of where things are going. It's a pretty hot topic, and you know, we could easily spend probably 3 hours just talking about that, but I'll try to kind of reserve it for the end. We're really fortunate to have some people here today who are living deep in the murky, swampy trenches of online radio. So hopefully we'll gain some interesting insights. So let's start out by having everybody introduce themselves, tell us a little bit about who they are, what you do, and what your companies do. I'll start with Nancy.
Hi, I'm Nancy Miller. I'm an editor at Wired Magazine. I do most of the magazine's pop culture and general cultural coverage, and I've been there since 2006.
My name is Anu Kirk. I'm the director of product management for Rhapsody, which is a digital music service. I've been working in the digital music business for almost 10 years, and I'm a musician myself.
I'm Tom Conrad. I'm the CTO and head of the product organization at Pandora, which is a personalized internet radio service.
My name is Anil, and I'm the director of new media for KCRW and KCRW.com. Been with them for about a year and a half in this iteration. Was with them back in the mid-90s for about 3 years, and basically just oversee the web operation and strategy for KCRW.
Thanks, guys. So let's start and talk about where we're headed from a products and features perspective. It's clear, I think, to everybody in the room that with online radio, even today, there's diversity that can't be touched on traditional radio. So what do we have to look forward to in receiving an improved personalized music experience, or at the minimum, improved alternatives to mainstream music experience? I'll start with you, Tom.
Well, at Pandora, you know, the thing that we're most keyed into is this transition that radio is going through from a broadcast medium to running on a substrate that's kind of a unicast medium. So, you know, there are 150 million Americans who listen to radio every week. They listen for 17 hours on average to music radio compared to 3 hours of music they own. So it's a fantastically important, you know, venue for music. And it's going through a pretty fascinating transition as we move to a world where instead of just having, you know, 100 stations across the FM and AM dials, we can have a kind of infinite number of stations that understand who you are as an individual. As we move to better wireless infrastructure, they can be with you wherever you go, in your home, in your car, at your office, and constantly be introducing you to music that would be otherwise unavailable. So it's sort of that intersection of this new ubiquitous bidirectional infrastructure married with technologies that allow us to understand your musical preferences and deliver specifically the kind of music that you love.
Anu, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind, of course, is that internet radio isn't really radio in any sense of the word. Internet radio is sort of a metaphor for a mode of delivering content to people. And that analogy of thinking of it as radio can be very destructive and confusing, but it's important to keep in mind. I think when you think about the types of features that will be coming along for internet radio, I mean, we've already gone through sort of the first wave of things, right? You have massive scale, so there's really an infinite number of stations that can be generated, to Tom's point about the relative limitations on physicality. There are varying degrees of interactivity, right? Can you skip? Can you save tracks? Can you click through to a website to buy stuff? That stuff has been fairly well exploited as well, and at some point, if you cross a certain threshold on interactivity, and it stops really being even remotely related to a radio type of experience. Sort of by statute, most of the radio stations are already providing a sort of metadata that you can't get through traditional terrestrial radio, like album cover and what record label it's on. You know, nobody ever announces that stuff, even on college stations. I think that the next sort of things that you'll be seeing have to do with things like community, you know, finding a way to connect to the other people that happen to be listening to the radio channel that you happen to be enjoying at a particular point in time. Like right now, when we think of radio, we think of you sort of sitting by yourself listening and knowing that there are other people out there, but the next logical step would be to connect you to the other people that are out there. And I think the other thing that you'll start to see is perhaps more of a focus on doing things by location of where the user is. So that's where I see it going.
You know, this addresses an issue that I think that we've had at Wired trying to cover this, and I don't think that we've done this successfully. And I think the reason why is we haven't really known where to sort of plant our flag. When you talk about the future of internet radio, and we talk about social networking sites and the fusion of those, I guess we're just, you know, at Wired trying to figure out how these are going to blend together. When you talk about the sort of point of internet radio and where it's going. So I have to confess that, you know, there's a reason why we haven't really been jumping on this, and we've been trying to explore it ourselves. So I guess I'm here to listen to a part of that and chime in, and I'm curious about what's going to happen myself. So I'm digging for a story at the same time.
So, I mean, today when it comes to personalization, it seems like there's a lot of different ways to go about doing it. We've got models where, you know, things like the Music Genome Project, which kind of draws musical attributes to determine similarities. We've got other models which are kind of more of the Last FM style, which is drawing kind of personalization through collaborative filtering based on collecting usage data from listeners. We've also got people are doing things with digital signal processing today, similar to the Music Genome Project, which is using more kind of digital signal processing to determine similarities between songs.
I think there's being three categories of kind of approaches for okay. Recommendation and personalization. There's quantitative metadata-driven approaches, so things that are just, you know, quantitatively true about the music. It has a certain kind of guitar, it has a certain number of beats per minute, and so on. That's sort of what the Music Genome Project is about. There's a sort that's based on more qualitative information. These bands are related. These bands belong to a particular genre. Things where there's sort of an editorial voice that's making a qualitative or subjective decision about what kinds of music belongs together. That might be the kind of data that you see in All Music Guide. And then there's these sort of social or collaborative systems where usage patterns and community influence, you know, kind of rule the day. And I think what we're seeing across all of the successful services is sort of a stepping away from religion about any one of those things being the right answer. Certainly at Pandora, in the beginning, all we had was the Music Genome Project, and so all of the playlists were informed only by the Music Genome Project. But today, the Music Genome is just one small element in a much sort of richer combination of approaches that use social data, that use more qualitative metadata to try to drive the best possible playlist.
So you're saying at Pandora you're not just relying on that music genome data anymore to drive personalizations?
Yeah, those playlists were pretty mediocre, actually.
Really?
And we stopped. It was pretty easy in the beginning. We really believed that it was like the one true way, and then we started looking at the data, and it's like, huh, every single person who listens to the Massive Attack station thinks this J-Lo song sucks on this Massive Attack station. Maybe we shouldn't play it anymore. And so there's, you know, some of those things are just self-evident. In the beginning, it was maybe controversial because it, you know, kind of ran in, you know, the face of our internal religion. But when you start to look at the data, it was pretty uncontroversial.
So you're actually using the explicit data inputs from the thumbs up and thumbs down to help train the system for the people who are brand new?
Sure, absolutely.
So if everybody hates something, you're just starting to pull it out of the program.
It's important
to
understand that that's all contextualized. So, you know, that J-Lo song might suffer at the hands of the crowd for Massive Attack, but the inverse isn't automatically true, that Massive Attack songs may work quite well on a J-Lo station. And it doesn't make any sort of overall, you know, summary judgment about that J-Lo song. It's just in that one particular context. It just seems sort of foolish to play it for each and every user who comes to the site. Now, that song may come back in as the user gives thumbs ups and down to songs on the station as they sort of push to a particular segment that maybe is less concerned about the social constructs and more concerned about the underlying musicology.
See, I think this is interesting, back to my earlier point about the analogy between radio and internet radio being somewhat destructive or obscuring the real issues. Like, I'm sure that Anil has quite a bit to say about the role of the actual tastemaker in radio. one of the things that when internet radio first started out, people were like, oh, it's so great because I don't have some DJ picking stuff for me and I don't have people talking at me all the time and I get more control. But it turns out that there are a lot of people that like to have a DJ pick music for them and that like having those sorts of talk ups. So I think there's this one of the sort of fundamental questions you ask about internet radio as well. Is it something that should have a tastemaker driven option? Or is it something that should be personalized, or should users have the ability to choose or float between those two things? Well, and I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about it.
I mean, curating, it seems like that's the appeal of most of this stuff, not necessarily the personalities. And I guess that's what differentiates standard radio with internet radio, but it seems like...
Right. I was going to say...
I'm sorry. is that better? Anyway, I'm just saying that the curating... That you guys are doing, I guess, is the appeal versus the personality driven. And with KCRW, is an excellent example of that, of a brand that has expanded itself
right. Well,
online.
I think, just speaking to Anu's points, he actually said two things that I think are really important to us. So one, which is where I don't exactly agree with Anu, is that KCRW is embracing radio. So for us, the internet, mobile, any of this stuff is really, they're just platforms, right? It's not content, it's not an end in and of itself. So for us, the paradigm is radio. How do we use the technologies, the interactive technologies that are out there, to do radio better? We're not suddenly going to become a video radio station. So, the last couple of years, a lot of talk about video, and people are like, you guys should stick, video cameras in your studios. And we're like, well, who wants to sit and listen, watch a DJ's talking head, basically? It doesn't make sense. So on one hand, for us, it's about how do we do radio better? So use the technology to actually present the interactivity that a user wants, present choice, present them as many options as we can, but within the context of what we feel our brand is about, which is about curation. So, we're not trying to go the route of Pandora. I think that's a great model, as well as Last FM or any of the other stations out there that are online. For us, it is about, in a way, old world meets new world, where, our brand is about sort of separating what we think is the best music that's out there, the best, presentation of news, the best presentation of arts programming, and actually putting that online and making that available. So we're doing the work of curation and editing. Hopefully that appeals to our listener base. That's what we're known for, and that's what we want to do better and expand and really build on. So for us, that's really what it's about.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the problem is, I love KCRW, and I mean, as a consumer of radio, one of the challenges that I have online is finding these stations that are well curated. You'll go into like an iTunes directory and there's just tons of call letters, and like, I don't know about the station in Austin. I don't know about the cool college radio station in Southern California. I know my local ones, my local college radio station. I just happen to know KCRW from going to LA a lot. To me, I think there's a challenge, or maybe there's a needed solution somewhere down the road where it's easier, to find these stations that are well curated. I mean, I think that's part of the appeal of the Pandora, which is it's just there. You don't have to do a lot of research or listen to tons of stations to find them. So,
well, true, but at some point you had to find out about Pandora as well, right? So theoretically, KCRW sort of works the same way. I mean, we have about 40% of our traffic is California, 42% or so is national or outside of California, and then about the remaining 18% or whatever it is international. And really, I mean, we haven't done much marketing of our station outside of our coverage area and then some of the events that we do around the country. Everything else has really just been through word of mouth. Now, I think that's really powerful, and hopefully that does work. Or
it helps for you guys when there's stories in New York Times Magazine and everywhere you go about KCRW.
I just to bring up sort of the devil's, opposite point of view. I thought the reason
you're here to represent the devil.
Yes.
Awesome.
I guess I thought that we left terrestrial radio because there was too much same same, and I guess that's my sort of issue with, even with KCRW that I love very much, but I thought we left to get to find diversity online. Where is that diversity online? And do you feel like there's a little bit too much curation, a little bit too much same-same?
Well, I personally don't. I mean, I think online there's a massive amount of diversity.
Yeah, I think we're
even compared to satellite radio, I'm already bored with my Sirius satellite radio. There's not that many stations that I find interesting, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but you know, I really want to find out like when I can get this stuff in my car and in my portable, because satellite's already not working for me.
I mean, I think, you know, at Pandora, we have a real religion about trying to personalize the service to everyone who comes to the site, to the point that there's nowhere you can go on Pandora to understand what the most popular artists are. You know, we have people who listen to each and every song that comes through, and so we're exposed to artists, you know, on a continual basis. We have all kinds of opinions about the great music that has come into the genome this week, but none of that would ever make it on the site. From the standpoint that we want to be kind of a blank slate for the person who comes to the site. So if it's somebody who is really, really passionate about gospel music, like we're not sort of biasing that by saying, you know, like, you know, Bon Iver is the cool band this week that you should like. Because we do think that that point pushes towards a certain kind of homogenization that these new technologies let us leave behind.
Right.
One thing I wanted to touch on a little bit that... where I think maybe Anu and I differ a bit just in terms of how we think about what this is we think about ourselves as a radio service. I mean, Pandora is radio, and we think that while maybe a broad class of terrestrial radio sort of misplayed their hand, there's a lot that's really good about radio. I mean, radio, you know, is very, very simple. You know, you press one button and there is music. Your mood changes, you press another button and there's a different kind of music. It presents music with some repetition, and you know, the thing that most correlates with whether you like a song or not is whether you've heard it before. So repetition is an important element in any kind of radio-like service. Radio stations do have community. You know, there's certainly there's listener parties and call-in shows, and you know, there is a sort of notion of community around radio. There's a serendipitous sort of character to it, where they take you from one kind of music to another kind of music. There's always a discovery angle where new artists, even on a clear channel station, new artists are coming into the mix and you're discovering music you might not hear otherwise. And so we sort of embrace all of that about radio and try to leave behind some of the things that have, you know, come with the clear channel era and with the limitations of broadcast and so on.
Well, I don't tend to be very dogmatic about it, but I would, knowing broadcasters and talking to them, I would argue that your definition of radio could be fulfilled by a CD changer. It's got a limited set of music that's going to flow together, and it's stuff that you're familiar with, and it goes on and on. And if you talk to the guys that do broadcasting, they believe that the actual programming, the personalities, the curation, if we want to use that term, is a key part of their value add. I'm not saying that I prefer one over the other. I think that, you know, Rhapsody offers radio that in many ways is functionally similar to what you guys offer as well. My point is simply that when you're looking at the types of radio experiences that can be provided, the unending stream of music, regardless of how tightly or loosely it's centered around your preferences or the DJ preferences, is one way of conceiving of internet radio, right? It's just, I turn it on and I sit back and I don't have to think about it and the music keeps playing. But there is a whole other set of values of radio that isn't captured by that type of experience. And for some people, that other set of values is the piece that's really important. Right. And to date, our service doesn't do a real great job of capturing it. Yours doesn't. In some sense, you could, if I'm trying to be pithy about it, I could say that what KCRW is doing is taking radio and putting it on the internet in some fashion. But that's very different from internet radio. You guys follow me there?
Well,
I think it depends on your definition of internet radio. I mean, we're only just getting started, really, with what we're doing online right now with KCRW. So basically, what happened is we were sort of one of the first stations to go online with our stuff back, I think, in like 96, 97, and that was a large part thanks to Real, who initially made it possible for us. And then we were one of the first stations to really embrace podcasting on a pretty large scale. What happened, though, in the last few years, though, is I think we fell a little bit behind, sort of got a little comfortable with the technology and what we were doing and basically stuck with it. So we're now sort of launching back into really looking ahead and trying to figure out what we should be doing online. And I think actually just taking an on-air broadcast or even creating original programming for the web, which is what we do a lot of as well, and just streaming that is really just one part of the equation. So, you know, whether it's feedback, user engagement, community, right? Any of that stuff. Like, we're really starting to take a really hard look at what we should be doing there. And hopefully in the next, you know, starting now to the next couple of years, we've actually got an outline of a roadmap of the areas where we want to go. To talk to Nancy's point, I think about diversity. You know, KCRW definitely has a point of view, and it is very, in some ways, maybe LA-based. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. That's just the reality of it. We have a huge, huge library, which some of you may have heard. We're now in the process of digitizing the entire library of something like 80,000, 90,000 CDs, records, vinyls, all this kind of stuff. So hopefully all of that is going to add to the diversity that we're actually presenting online, because it's going to make the music much more accessible to the DJs. It is true, this isn't just sort of marketing speak. I mean, we don't have any
playlists. Taking notes. He's going to call you to get work out a licensing deal afterwards.
Don't have any playlists. You know, it's truly, like, we present the playlists of our shows, but everything that each DJ puts together for his or her show is created from scratch by them, no guidelines, whatever they want to do. And we think that that brings in as much diversity as that DJ is capable of bringing in, and hopefully we'll do more of that.
So one thing I ask myself, I mean, we're all here at South by Southwest, we're like living in the long tail. Does the majority of the people in the future, you know, just want those 10 stations? Is it the hit station? You know, there's a large group of people, they go to college, they listen to music, then they have kids, and then for the rest of their lives, they listen to that same stuff. And the college radio station's always staring at them on the dial, but they never go there. You know, they just want to hear classic rock. Do we think that in the future, you know, with a diversity of possibly having internet radio in the car and tons of stations, that 90% of the people are going to listen to those same 10 stations?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think some of the most passionate responses we get from our listeners come from people who say, you know, the last time I felt connected to music was when I was in high school or college. You know, I have a collection of music that, you know, I've got my, you know, Blue Oyster Cult records and my, you know, whatever. And that's sort of all that I listen to, in a way, have fallen out of love with music. And they come to Pandora and they say that they like the Blue Oyster Cult, and we play similar music from that era, sure, but also a lot of new music that operates under some similar musical principles. And those are the reactions that are the most passionate, in terms of when people write in. They write in and say, you know, we've just exposed me to a whole world of music that I didn't even know existed, starting from, you know, where my taste sort of dried up when I was in college, and now I'm expanding out to, you know, all kinds of new sort of musical horizons just based on you know, starting from what I knew. So those are the ones that always touch me the most.
I always felt there should be a slider, like, never introduce anything new to me versus I never want to hear anything twice.
Well, I think it sort of depends on which type of music you're talking about. I mean, we have a little bit of a bias here in that most of the people in this room like music and care about it. And the fact is that most people in the world don't. And for those people, they're perfectly content with whatever they grew up with. I mean, music.
You really believe that most people in the world don't like music and care about it?
From the perspective of level of interest and the level of things that they're willing to invest, statistically, that's the truth.
Well, that's the success of radio. It's passive listening.
Yeah. I think it's a mistake to assume, because the people in this room have a kind of passion for a kind of a lean-in music experience, mm-hmm. that the people who want to lean back and spend 17 hours listening to radio every week are somehow not in love with music.
Allow me to finish and clarify here. So my point here was that there are people who have a lower level of engagement with music, and they're very happy listening to the stuff that they grew up with. There's only a certain amount of time they're willing to invest in finding new music, and discovery for them is not that important. It's of limited value to them in their culture and community in a daily basis. They will flip on the radio because they like stuff, but they're not driven to seek new things out to the threshold where they want to go find out if there is even a way to find out about new music, right? So I think those people are going to be happy listening to the same sorts of things over and over again. They might even go so far as to get serious, but they'll converge, or XM, they'll converge on the three stations that they like, right? There is some number of people for whom some level of music discovery is important, and one of the great things about Pandora and other services like Rhapsody is that it enables discovery in an easy way that's a little bit more friction-free. There's a ton of diversity out there now. You can find internet radio stations that will narrowcast whatever type of music you like, however you want to do it. So it's there for people who are interested. Even for people that like to explore music, they still have boundaries. You know, they hit that wall pretty quickly. So I think it's just people's nature. There's a certain amount of music that most people are willing to investigate, a certain amount of effort they're willing to put in. And whether they're listening to one radio station on their FM dial because that's easy, or the one internet radio station they stumble across on the internet because that's easy, I think a lot of people will end up there. The good news is, if you care about music and you like to explore, the possibilities are limitless now and for the foreseeable future, and I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think people definitely gravitate towards a certain sensibility. So, you know, the capacity to sort of like incorporate unlimited amounts of new stuff in your life is I think kind of limited. So everybody sort of gravitates maybe towards a sensibility that they're about or that they believe in or that they feel they belong to. We cater to a certain sensibility. I think there's people that hate KCRW and that's fine, you know, and then there's people that love us and seem to want to listen more and more. So, I mean, either way, I think it's okay. I think the difference, though, is that it's not, we don't really make the distinction between lean back and lean forward. I think we want to try and sort of incorporate both of those experiences. So if somebody wants a lean forward experience within the context of what we can offer, we want to offer that as well as lean back. But the sensibility that we're about, you know, that's what we sort of want to try and keep hold on to and perhaps grow if possible.
Can I take a quick poll while we're here, just for all of our education? How many people in the room listen to the radio more than they choose music on demand at iTunes? It doesn't matter. Just passive, sit back. I'm not engaged. The music's washing over me.
I actually don't care if it's
if it's terrestrial, online, or satellite,
you're not picking the songs.
Do you prefer the passive music listening experience of radio over on-demand iTunes? Yeah. I'm just asking a show of hands. You're 50-50.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll ask 50-50 after. How many radio more than on-demand? Okay. How many on-demand more than radio? How many 50-50?
Yeah. The same answer is very clearly
50-50.
I ask myself this question all the time. I'm in my car, and I'm going back and forth between kind of my on-demand experience and radio. And I just wanted to gain some insight into what's actually more popular.
I think, you know, in some ways, it's sort of a false choice, right? Because for us, we have the advantage of having both. So we have terrestrial as well as we have online. So the way we see it is you have drive time. You got people driving in. They're listening to KCRW, hopefully, in their cars on their traditional radios. Then they get into work, and, you know, it's predictable, right? The listening hours start to go up. The number of listeners start to go up. Peaks around noon, drops in the afternoon. I mean, everybody's seen those curves. So
that's all radio-style listening, right?
But it's all radio-style listening.
They're not saying, I want to listen to the new Cure record. They're saying, I want to listen to a DJ program, serendipitous, discovery-oriented
Well,
program,
not
right?
exactly, though, because it's a combination, right? So we offer both live streaming as well as on-demand. So you can actually go back and now decide to listen to the archives that we have. And there's tons and tons. I mean, we have about 8,000 files and archives there. And range complete programs. So that's one thing that we don't do, right? So we don't actually offer single song things, or, you know, even within shows, we're only now offering some interactivity around segments, like being able to choose the segment that you want to listen to. But again, that just goes back to what we're about. So we don't necessarily curate or give users the choice within a song, but we give you a lot of choices, hopefully, within the show. So that's our sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, like basic unit. It's the show. It's not the song, right? And that's the pen that we play in.
Another way to rephrase my question is, you know, if there was ubiquitous broadband, right, in your portable, in your car, and your iPod conceptually, or whatever the device it is, also had personalized radio and a massive variety of stations, would more people be leaning towards that kind of passive radio experience be choosing from their active local collections?
Does anybody own a Slacker?
Not yet.
How about a higher Ibiza? Because we have that today. And it turns out that it really depends on how you measure. If you look at
Ibiza is not ubiquitous.
Right, or any,
there's
right,
no
or
ubiquitous
any,
broadband.
So, right, or
it's
any,
a huge deterrent for Ibiza today.
You own a Slacker? I mean, But that's, you know.
I mean, I think the answer is yes, right? I mean, there's internet radio on all kinds of cell phones. There's the Slacker device. There's Wi-Fi connected portable media players. There's the iPhone. And the answer is yes. Like, so, you know, there's a certain mood where you want.
The answer is yes. More people will listen to radio than local on demand.
I guess what I'm trying to say is there's certainly a strong place for both. I think as a more sort of as the types of radio that are available to you shift, I'm sure we'll see interesting changes. Right now, today, the answer to that question is really clear. 17 hours of music radio, 3 hours of music you own. I mean, maybe not in this room. Actually, I think it's pretty spectacular that in this audience, it's 50-50. But, you know, if you look across the U.S. in general, people listen to the radio.
Yeah. I mean, the passive, you know, when you, Mog's done some focus groups with people where they say, hey, online, you know, music is a background thing for me. I don't want to do a lot of thinking, and I just want to be washed over in passivity. So, you know, you think about, you know, the hype and how big the talk is around iTunes. I'm wondering that somewhere down the road is personalized radio with ubiquitous broadband actually going to be a much bigger thing?
Well, I don't work for Apple, but I would think that they would argue that that's really what their Shuffle All Songs feature is doing for people. It's like your own, it's your own personalized radio station made of your own favorite music.
Well, I mean, I think the thing about it, though, David, is that it's not just about music. I mean, radio encompasses a lot of news, a lot of talk, a lot of arts programming, you know, history, like pretty much anything you want. So when you start talking about, you know, content and people's, you know, listening habits or what they want, I mean, the universe is actually huge. And, you know, I don't really see anybody sitting there trying to, you know, create their own version of To the Point, you know, or a news show or something. I mean, you know, so that is essentially going to be, it's a lean back experience, but if they're interested, they are going to engage with that content. If they want to engage with that content, we are looking at ways to trying to give them more voice. So up until now, we haven't really done that. It's been very one way on our part. Again, we're looking to expand that a little bit. I mean, I think the question really when you talk about internet radio for us is more, maybe this gets really philosophical, is really what can we do to content? So there's always a lot of talk about technology. There's always a lot of talk about, you know, the latest design interfaces or whatever. But really, like, KCRW is about content. That's what I think why people like the station or love the station. If we didn't have content that they like, you know, as a brand, KCRW would be nothing. So, so for me, or for us, I should say, the questions start to become, as this technology evolves, as you get into things like the iPhone and you have, you know, location-aware stuff, you have mobility, you have interactivity, you have one-way streaming, is there any room here to actually start to play with the concept of storytelling, the concept of news reporting, the concept of how do you actually create a more engaging and interactive radio? I don't really have the answers to that, but I'd say that that's the kind of stuff that we're starting to actually have conversations about, because the rest of it really is just, you know, pretty much adapting something from one medium to the next.
Wouldn't it be great if you could kind of combine the trusted voice DJ with the personalization component of Pandora, where you're getting personalized radio and you're getting the voice?
Certainly, one of the many flaws of Pandora is that I think that overextended listening, it starts to feel kind of dead inside compared to what you might get from KCRW or what you might get from listening to, you know, Rusty or Elise's stations, where you get a sense of, you know, human being at work. And so that's certainly, I think, a big challenge for us, to, you know, just, you know, with an eye towards keeping someone as a listener for, you know, a year or 2 years or 3 years, this feeling that, like, you know, it's the machine is not conducive to that.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the massive popularity of things like Project Playlist, which is really about finding a trusted voice or discovery through taste sharing, you know, I ask myself, down the road in my 3G iPhone or in my 3G car, am I going to want that kind of social component involved, or am I going to prefer the more anonymous, personalized experience?
Well, to me, this is sort of one of the fundamental questions behind radio and programming in general, is like, how important is the role of the curator or the DJ? So there are plenty of people who will argue the way that Bob builds an 80s playlist is just awesome. I mean, he can put the Go-Go's next to Duran Duran like nobody's business. And there are other people who will argue that any algorithm, whether it's Pandora or Rhapsody or Shuffle, is going to do a job that's just about as good, if not better, right? So this is something that goes on and on. I mean, Tom can say, well, you know, we're concerned because it feels like the machine too much. And other people can say, I hate that this DJ does X, Y, or Z. In terms of the research I've done, it turns out that when you put DJs next to robots over a long period of time, they're all about 80%. I can give a playlist to my friend JP and say, what do you think of this? And he'll say, it's pretty good. I'd give it an 8 out of 10. And I'd say, a robot made that. and I can give him another one and say, well, what do you think about this one? And, you know, Dr. Johnny Fever made it. And he'd say, yeah, I'd give it about an 8 out of 10. So it really differs from individual to individual. And it's not clear to me that there is, over time and over a large group of people, an advantage to one methodology over another.
Right. Well, see, I disagree pretty. Sorry, go ahead, Nancy. What did you say?
No,
there's one big difference. That's the personal voice and the story of the song. And
absolutely.
And I think that's the big difference. And everybody's forgetting about that. And we need that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, take a look at.
What are you saying? So the personal person talking in between the songs, is that what you're saying?
It's the way the songs are mixed together. It's the personal. I mean,
you know,
all that
stuff. You
look
at how popular things like Pandora are, and things like Last FM are, and even the radio that's piped into your cable system. These things are really popular. You know,
I just don't think it's an either or thing. You know, it's just not an either or thing.
I don't think any of you are competitors.
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm sitting on my hands and raising it, and there's a microphone. I have a question for all of you. I know most of you.
It's not question time. I'm sorry. Please sit down.
You're so awesome.
Security.
it's a bummer.
It's Rupert Pupkin.
Opposed it all to each other on a panel. It bums me out, and here's why. I use all your services. I even use Sirius. I use Sirius because I love Howard Stern. I pay for Sirius $12 a month, now $14 for Howard. I don't listen to anything else on Sirius. The playlists suck. XM, no, and they don't have Howard. I love KCRW, and I've worked at record labels. You've broken bands for us, and you rock. Mog is awesome. I recommend it to every artist that wants to know how to market themselves. Pandora is a great service. I think it's pretty genius. Rhapsody, I listen to. I have a subscription. And
you're one out of 1,000, my friend.
But here's the thing. You came in.
I'm trying to gain some insight. What's
popular?
You
came in talking about products and features, and I kind of want to know, as products, who are your competitors? Who do you view as your biggest competitor? Because I will tell you, my mom, and there's no bias here, I swear, my mom can use Pandora. My mom can use Pandora, but I can't for the life of me teach her how to use Rhapsody. And it's kind of a heartbreaker, because I think she'd like both. So I want to know who your competitors are.
Well, from my perspective, just real quickly to follow this gentleman's point, what I was saying earlier is that half the people think DJs are valuable and half the people don't. So it's really a question of personal choice. We talk a lot at Rhapsody about who our competitors are. And to your mom, in the case of your mom, I know that it's too hard to use, and I am working very hard to try and make it easier because I'm tired of doing tech support for my own extended family. But, you know, one of the guys that works for me...
Can we give our moms your number?
Yes. One of the guys that works for me is a gentleman named Hector Lopez, and he was telling me that McDonald's has a big board up in their company headquarters as a map of the United States with this number on top of it. And this number shows the percentage of all of the meals in the world that McDonald's is serving. So think about that for a second. Their perspective, it's a tiny, tiny number, right? But McDonald's perspective is we want to have a percentage of every meal being served. And that's one approach Rhapsody could take, for example, or any of our companies could take to the business. We want a percentage of what I call ear share, right? If there's somebody listening, we want to have the opportunity to take advantage of that. But we also have to remain very tightly focused. There are some people who say, for example, oh, Pandora is a direct competitor to you guys because, you know, people are listening on their computers. Or there are people who say Sirius and XM are competitors because people are paying a monthly fee to get at a service that's providing music. You can make those sorts of arguments, but... You know, in terms of pure subscription businesses, there's Napster and there's Zune, and that's kind of about it. I think it really depends on what's important to you. For some people where music is clearly very important to you, you're willing to get the best service in every niche. Rhapsody doesn't have a good car solution yet. Portable solution is just kind of you know. So yeah. Sirius and XM do a much better job there. But I'm not going to try and spend $1 billion to launch satellites into space and go chase down all the car manufacturers this year to address it. So... For me, it's both.
The nice thing about online music consumption market is it's so massive that there's actually a room for a lot of different models. Mm-hmm. I'm still hoping to get some insights today, like what's going to be the more popular types of models.
Well, I mean, I want to answer the question about who we compete with. You know, Pandora recently became, on a listener hour basis, the largest internet radio site in the world. And even at that scale, we're less than 1% of all radio listening. So our competitors, so that means that the Rhapsody stations and the AOL stations and the, you know, all the Clear Channel stations and Launchcast and all of those are smaller than us. So like, I can't get bigger by beating them. So I don't compete with them. You know, I compete with Clear Channel and CBS Radio and XM and Sirius and Music Choice on cable. Those are my competitors. And the rest, I think, are you know, great other valuable digital music ecosystem players, but I don't compete with them. I can't win by beating them.
How do your numbers compare to XM and Sirius?
We're still somewhat smaller than them. We're bigger, just to put it in scale, to put it, to give you a sense, we're bigger than any single terrestrial station, but, you know, it's like, woohoo, we're bigger than the biggest station in New York, but not by much.
Right. I think for us, the question of competition, maybe because we're public broadcasting, it's less of a concern. So, I mean, I could say that, you know, each of these services here are our competitors. I mean, we would look at the newyorktimes.com and say that's a competitor because they have, you know, they're getting into audio, they're getting into video, right, as well as text. So they actually maybe have an advantage. I'll even look at CNN and say, I mean, anything that's any media site that's online is a potential competitor. Having said that, though, that's not what drives us. I mean, our point is, you know, we have the sensibility, we have what we're trying to do with our content, and that's really what we base the choices on. We don't really spend a lot of time looking at, you know, so what new feature did so-and-so site add that we now need to emulate or copy or whatever. I mean, it's maybe it is the luxury of public broadcasting. I don't know. But at the same time, we want to be competitive in terms of the services that we offer. So if a user has expectations online of what's possible because that's what's being offered online, then we want to at least be able to offer equal amount of services, you know, the technical interactivity, that kind of stuff.
So we got a lot of ground to cover. I'm going to really ask for questions at the end. Couple more questions. One more question on kind of features front. When do we think that the reality of ubiquitous broadband will be here where we could get internet radio off the web? Anybody want to chime in? Anybody have thoughts?
I mean, Pandora is available today on 45 AT&T and Sprint phones. And the biggest issues with
that's on Edge.
The Edge and HSDPA and 3G network on AT&T and eVideo on Sprint.
Is that working well as far as
it delivers a surprisingly good listening experience. I mean, you can absolutely, you know, take your cassette adapter, plug your Sprint phone into your dash, and, you know, drive across Northern California and never, you know, your stream will break up less than your XM or Sirius stream does.
So my phone connection might die, but the radio never does?
Shockingly, yes, because we do a lot of buffering and a whole bunch of other things right. To try to make the experience better. But there's a bunch of crappy things about it, like, God help you, hiding the adapter to get from, you know, the wacky USB audio connector on your phone to the, you know, cassette adapter, or, you know, oh, isn't it awesome that when I close the clamshell, the application is quit for me? So you're walking around with your phone, like, hanging out of your pocket like some kind of idiot. So, you know, there's all kinds of just, you know, practical challenges. Some of the carriers are still really concerned about how they use bandwidth overall. So every 20 minutes, they automatically stop the stream because what if you left it sitting on your desk and walked away? So
you might be using our data network.
Yeah, exactly. And so we're at the beginning of that transition. And, you know, I don't think there's, you know, I think the only thing you can really say about the mobile market at any given point is 2 years from now, you know, things are going to be awesome. That'll be equally true a year from now.
Has online radio taken off in Europe with kind of the...
It's got some usage over there. I mean, there are different offerings that are available, but in terms of the portable internet, it's not really at that level yet for the... Yeah.
So even though they have 3G there, it's still not that popular.
3G is not a magic bullet. Right. When you look at the actual amount of data that you can push to a 3G cell simultaneously, all of the carriers are really concerned that even one or two streaming radio users can block out an entire cell. So they're terrified and really reluctant to do anything with radio streaming. So it's not going to happen over the phone network. I don't want to speculate about like when WiMAX covers the country.
It's going to happen over the phone network. It's going to happen over the phone network. WiMAX will be the phone network.
Well, that's true. But I mean, you're changing the terminology over here. At some point, WiMAX is going to
be owned by the
blanket everything.
Sure.
Right? There will be ubiquitous internet, and when that happens, it's going to blow our minds in a way that actually getting wired internet blew our minds. Only this is going to be an order of magnitude more. I don't know when that's going to be.
So one of the problems
I wish it was tomorrow.
The product development cycles for cars is so long.
That's an issue,
they're,
too.
They're not going to, you know, I was formerly the CEO at Gracenote, so, you know, the deals that I did in 2001 are now coming out now. So.
And we thank you for the quarter-inch audio adapter.
Yeah.
So we're also, you know, concerned about
if the car guys start doing WiMAX 5 years from now, it could be, you know, 12 to 15 years before you actually have it in the car.
I think kind of, you know, trying to play the technology game is sort of a loser's game. I mean, if you really want to be out on the bleeding edge, you're going to lose a lot of money and spend a lot of time and probably not really get anywhere. That's you know, my opinion, I guess. I mean, I would say that for us, we're you know, we don't necessarily want to be on the bleeding edge, but at least try to be creative with the tools that you have. So I think one of the things that might be an opportunity is that podcasts up until now have been a fairly linear experience. You know, you download a single show, you kind of, you know, download a bunch of different shows from different podcasts that you subscribe to. Well, I think there might be some opportunities there in actually creating an entire 8-hour block of audio that somebody can download and take with them if they're going on a trip. So, you know, maybe, right? So it could be a combination. If I was to take our whole day part programming, I would say, okay, here's music, a show, or a special license that we can get for a performance, make that available as a download podcast. I mean, we do that right now with Morning Becomes Eclectic, certain shows, and then you have news and talk and stuff. So the idea is to say, well, instead of just downloading a single show, let's give somebody a 2 or 3 hour block so they can literally take the station with them, you know, and in the interim, that might actually be kind of a fun idea.
Yeah, and the licenses for those kinds of time-shifted models exist. I mean, Slacker, you know, has bought into those licenses. So, you know, people are experimenting with those forms.
So let's move over to monetization. So the labels, you know, they're very, very hungry animals these days.
Cornered hungry animals.
Yeah, they're dying.
Wounded, cornered, hungry animals.
They're kind of like Donner Party.
Good people.
They're getting very hungry. They're looking at things like terrestrial radio, and they're saying, you know, you guys have to start paying us.
Well, Clear Channel, it is patently ludicrous that they don't pay anything.
You know, Clear Channel, you're making all the money. We're not making money. We need to make some money here, and we need to start making money on all the places that are kind of monetizing off of our content where we're not monetizing it. So, you know, they see the internet as this new frontier to try to make a lot of money off of it. And so I guess one of my questions is, I mean, I don't know how familiar everybody is in the audience with kind of what's been going on in with the rates, but they started to improve things a little bit for the small broadcasters where they created a revised pricing structure where if you're, you know, making less than $1.25 million, you don't have to pay the per song, per stream fee, which is, I believe, about a tenth of a penny per song per stream, but this guy's been very vocal that they need to raise that to $6 million, like the small.
The audience size is big, they limit it to, I think, 5 million listeners.
So I mean, do these guys have, you know, is there legitimacy to their issue that people just aren't figuring out how to monetize it and that's not their issue and they want a base level rate? Or are they being short-sighted and saying, look, it's a developing market, let's create a more flexible pricing structure for the small guys?
I mean, what happened? I mean, every 4 years, the Copyright Royalty Board was the first time they actually ever met. But at least in theory, every 4 years, the Copyright Royalty Board meets to establish prices for internet radio. Everybody who's ever bought a car knows that the dealer says, I want this much, you say, I want this much, and you land somewhere in the middle. Well, everyone understands that except, apparently, the Copyright Royalty Board. And so the rights holder said, we want this much, the webcaster said, we want it to cost this much, and the Copyright Royalty Board decided that it should cost this much. And part of the immediate reaction to that was, on the rights holder side, they were like, oh, shit! Because even they knew that the price that they asked for was ludicrously industry-ending, you know, levels. And so the last year, literally it's been a year now, we've spent talking with them both in public and private forums. When I say us, I mean, you know, coalition of webcasters, big and small, to try to get this resolved. And there have been times when it's looked, you know, they've been somewhat emboldened by this. Oh my God, we got this ludicrous, you know, industry-ending rate. You know, let's leverage this, you know, leverage the hell out of this. But by the same token, I really do think at this point, it's on a path to resolution that will allow internet radio to survive. And, you know, we'll send you an email if that turns out to not be true, and you can help us
find
your
job.
Well, I believe internet radio will survive. The question is, can there be a proliferation of small players who can have kind of successful businesses, not just the guys who've kind of hit the bar and they're already kind of one of the big guys now? I mean, Pandora, you're one of the big guys now.
Yeah,
as far as online radio is concerned.
I mean, there continues to be a carve out for different classes of internet radio that reaches a smaller audience. The National Public Radio is negotiating for separate terms. I think in the end, there's always going to be this challenge about the kind of small guy who dreams of becoming a big guy, and what happens when you cross that threshold between the definition of small and the definition of large. And so I think that's probably, in terms of proliferation of the smaller players, probably the biggest remaining question. Is one of the things that Rusty has worked really hard on, for example, to try to ensure that the new rates sort of accommodate some kind of a transition that wouldn't, you know, kill you dead, you know, when you reach 5 million in one listener hours.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, I mean, we really believe that, you know, the artists and the labels should get royalties. I mean, we definitely believe that. The part where I think there's a difference between what Sound Exchange wants and what we're asking for is a recognition that we are non-commercial radio. So the FCC recognizes us as being a different entity. The IRS recognizes us as being a different entity. But Sound Exchange won't, right? They're like, no, if you cross a certain threshold, you're paying commercial rates. We don't care who you are. So, which doesn't really work for us, because that's just not what our model is based on. I mean, we're very much about getting the content out there first. We try to recoup, you know, earn something through membership or merchandising or even sponsorships on the back end just to cover our costs. We're not in it to make money. And so we really just feel that Sound Exchange needs to recognize that as a difference and acknowledge it, and then come up with rates that are different.
Just to play devil's advocate for a minute, does that mean that anybody who's not out to make money should be able to play music as much as they want at low or zero rates?
Well, I mean, I don't know about that.
We could just decide to not be in it to make money, too, and then we could play the music?
We're recognized as a nonprofit entity. That's our mission. Our mission is public broadcasting. It is getting content out there. You know, if a guy in a basement wants to create a radio station and not make money off of it, I'm not...
yeah, we're still a .org, but technically.
So, well, I mean, where are you guys with resolving it, though? Because last I heard, it's still negotiation.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. But at some level, I do think that there is a responsibility. If you're going to take music that is the, you know, blood, sweat, and tears of musicians, you can't just hide behind we're not for profit and build a sort of listening experience.
Well, yeah, but we're saying
that content,
that we are still willing to pay royalties. I mean, we've taken a principled stand on this to say that, you know, we want to pay royalties to artists, we want to pay royalties to the labels. We believe that that's perfectly legitimate. It's just a question of what should that rate be. So we're not saying no royalties. We're just saying, as a non-commercial entity, you know, there needs to be a difference. What we do is very different from what Clear Channel does, and you have to really recognize that.
Yeah, but this is the difference between terrestrial broadcasting, which has a set of licenses and regulations that understand a certain type of paradigm, and the internet, which is totally different. In direct response to your question, Dave, in terms of whether it's going to be possible for small webcasters to flourish, that's basically 100% dependent on the outcome of these negotiations. And as it stands right now, it's frankly not clear. Yeah. I mean, it really is up to the rules that get set. To be fair, it's basically the same thing in the terrestrial radio world. You can't just throw up an antenna and start broadcasting. I mean, you can, but the FCC will track you down like Christian Slater in that movie and find out where you are and you know, smash your equipment with bats. So there is some notion that, you know, this does need to be regulated in some form or another. And I don't honestly know how it's going to play out. I think that it's a shame. You know, when you look at the history of terrestrial radio, it's the record companies, the music business, trying so hard to get their product into your ears that they'll break federal law again and again and again, right, and get caught by people like Elliot Spitzer, in order to get that music on the air into your ears, right? The internet comes along and it's this endless cornucopia with all these stations and things that people can listen to, and we're willing to pay both the sound recording owner and the composition owner at a reasonable rate, and instead they're just throwing nails in the road trying to stop it. It's madness.
Well, and then you think about the deal that AOL just made with CBS Radio. I mean, that's kind of huge, right? Because all of a sudden a huge terrestrial network is now going to be online with, I think, 200-plus channels on AOL. I mean, that's incredible.
And they'll be subject to internet radio royalties.
To me, what a lot of that is about.
Sure, but it is a model of a large, you know, terrestrial traditional broadcaster now actually making a huge online play, probably at the expense of a whole bunch of independent, you know, small internet radio stations.
I think let me interject here. I think it's a big issue is that online advertising has been so hard to monetize. For some reason, it has been a big black hole for advertisers. So AOL can't even monetize their own radio.
And that's because
CBS, which has a very large kind of installed ad sales network for terrestrial, will throw online in as a value add, as a part of the deal.
They'll be able to
monetize it much better than AOL ever did.
And that,
so one of my big questions is, why is online so hard for advertisers to buy into?
It's because everyone who's tried to monetize online radio has tried to do it with audio ads, and there is no market for audio ads on a national scale. There's not. It doesn't exist. So
why?
Why? Because all the audio ads you hear on the radio are for the local car dealership. And, you know, even as the biggest internet broadcaster, I got like seven guys listening in Columbus, Ohio.
You can do reverse IP and do localization.
Right. There's seven guys in Columbus, Ohio listening.
Nobody wants to pay to reach seven people.
Exactly.
Right. But the other part about it is also supply and demand. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, it's supply and demand, right? So online, whether it's banner ads or whether it's radio or TV, I mean, the more content that's out there, the more supply there is. And so therefore, you know, you're really just, there's a lot of downward pressure on the CPM rates. So that's actually a problem. So again, I mean, you know, if you're a brand like Pandora, maybe KCRW, we're trying to pitch to sponsors on the strength of our brand and the quality of our listenership, not the numbers game. If you play the numbers game, you have to lose because it's just supply and demand, and supply is going to constantly increase exponentially online.
So going back to your statement, why isn't there national audio ads?
Well,
you have 50 million online listeners. It's a captive audience. It's not
because all of the creative energy at the ad agency level is going into television and online,
right.
Interactive
right.
online.
Right.
You know, the guys who are charged with doing national audio campaigns, and there are some, right? You hear ads for movies and automobiles on terrestrial radio. You do. That's not the hot freaking job at, you know, Avenue A Razorfish to be the guy who comes up with audio ads for radio. It's just not. So for us, the answer has been to try to be creative about the kinds of ads that we run. So all of the advertising on Pandora is display advertising. The only time we ever show ads is when the user interacts with the player. God bless our users. They lean in to rate songs and skip and pause and change the volume and learn more about the artists. And we show them what we hope is a relevant display ad. So we tap into that pool of creative content. We also sell all of our own advertising. We have 25 people all over the country who go out and meet face-to-face with the advertising agencies and the brands themselves and do what you have to do when you only have, you know, 5 million Comscore uniques or whatever. You got to do an evangelical sell. And a lot of other internet radio has, you know, signed up for an ad network for their display ads, has signed up for, you know, an audio ad network so they can try to break this logjam of scale, right? So, like, everybody, you know, AOL and Launchcast and everybody pulls together and use Ron and Lipset to run, you know, the local car dealership ads at $2 CPMs, and you have to run 50 of them an hour to break even. So, you know, I think part of it is there just hasn't been a lot of creative thinking applied to the problem of how to monetize in the internet radio space.
By the way, I'm told we're allowed to go over when you're the last guy, right? So I want to have questions from all the audience, but so one more question for you guys on the subject of monetization and advertising. Which is, we've had these hard issues about audio ads online. Could there be some kind of, there was an article in Business Week, I think a week ago, about the fact that somebody needs to create an ad insertion system like Google AdWords for online radio, where anybody can make an audio ad by the time and insert it directly into a Pandora and online radio station.
It actually exists. I mean,
there's a bunch of companies that have done this over the years. Yeah.
Google bought a company called DMARC to do just that. They're doing both terrestrial radio insertion and online radio insertion. It's not working at all based on what I've heard. because you have the same problem that you have with the local car dealership, right, but writ large, which is now you've got like mom with her crochet, like, you know, products that she's selling that wants to hyper target, that wants to pay on a cost per click basis, and you just can't, right, you can't make it ROI positive at the current scale. Right.
So note to advertisers, you guys are missing out. There's 50 million online listeners, and it's an untapped market. Instead of putting your banners on pages where there's a proliferation of other ads and you're not really getting your message across, there's a huge opportunity here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. So let's go to questions. Any questions from the audience?
I have a
anyone who has a question has to walk over to the microphone. So
I have a question that's all about me instead. I had a comedy radio show for like 6 years and way back in the 90s. And since then, I've been getting like a lot of emails and all that kind of stuff going, gee, we really want to hear that bit again. So it's taken me to a level of getting it on CDs. And then I thought, and I tried to hook up with somebody that's smarter than me, which isn't that hard to put together a website. And I'm just wondering, is it, and I hope you have a 5-second delay because I'm going to say, you know, I don't know what the fuck to do.
Hey, it's the interweb. Say whatever you want.
Oh, well, right there. That was it. Where, what the fuck do I do? Do you guys take, I mean, do you purchase shows or do I just hold on to doing a website, you know, and selling CDs that way?
There's a couple different things you could do. You could go to an aggregator like IOTA or TuneCore and they'll take your CDs and ingest them and turn them into digital files and then get them onto all the services that are out there like iTunes and Rhapsody and Napster. And if you're just looking to get your stuff up and available and you want to make a little bit of money, that's one way to do it. You could put them up on BitTorrent if you just want to give them away for free or put them up on a website. But I would probably go the IOTA route.
If you have a name that people recognize.
Anyone from IOTA here in the audience, talk to any of these people with their hands up.
Do you want to do it for the art or do you want to do it to make money?
Yes.
Awesome. I'm out of ideas.
Do you have a name that people would recognize?
Well, it's been called Radio Shorts for a long time. Okay. Because they're like 2-minute bits.
Right.
And so, you know, it's like it was half hour weekly.
Are people typing that into Google trying to find it?
Not yet.
Okay.
That's
ground zero.
I think one of the things I would maybe suggest is to not build a website. So,
is that right?
You know, a lot of people sort of feel like they need to build a website, they hire a web designer, they spend, you know, anywhere from $1,000 to $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 design something really basic. They forget about marketing, they forget about updates. I mean, the easiest thing to do if you want to start communicating with people that are interested in your show, start a blog. I mean,
where's
it
Live
might be
365
cliche, but it's
these
very,
days.
Very easy. Start a blog. Use something like Vox where they allow you to post audio content really easy. Take like, you know, excerpts and stuff. Right. Just get started. Just start putting yourself out there. And you can do all of this stuff for like almost zero investment. And that's going to pay off way more than trying to find a web designer that's going to build you a special website. And I mean, just don't go down that road.
Does Live 365 still do stuff for any small person who wants to just start broadcasting?
Sure.
There you go, $20 a month, and they probably have directories, including like comedy directories, where people will stumble into your page and
do a podcast. I mean, you know, start recording. You know, my advice would be start recording your voice and get it out there however you can. Upload the files to Pounce. You know, put them in the iTunes directory as a podcast. You know, start building your audience, and if you manage to light that up, you'll be able to figure out a way to monetize it in the end.
Okay, next question. Thank you.
This should be real easy. I'm from a commercial radio station that has been broadcasting online for a number of years, and we've been broadcasting on Windows Mobile for about as long as it's been in existence. Mm-hmm. The iPhone came out, and now I'm getting emails from all of my listeners saying, I've got one of these things, and I can't stream you. Does anybody know how to stream to an iPhone?
You.
That's my next request.
You're better off just doing it as a progressive download.
And you'll get banned for being a bandwidth hog.
I mean, there are things like SeekPod, which are already streaming on the iPhone. So.
Yeah, you can stream.
That's what I said. Progressive download, and you're in business.
It's a horrible hack, but yeah. true.
Right. You can't change apps. There's no passive streaming. Right.
All right. Kind of going back to the ubiquitous bandwidth topic, since as someone who's actually working on converging a lot of different technologies to actually reach that point, because it is inevitable that it has to go there, how does that, once you start reaching that point, how does that affect your model as far as a business model and revenue model when you're relying on display ads?
We have to make audio work.
So the I had a second half of that question.
Gabe Adiv.
Assuming that, you know, all these folks are willing to place audio ads tomorrow, do you guys have the plumbing and infrastructure and the whole thing to support it?
We do.
Absolutely.
Yep, we do.
You guys using in-house technology or third party?
You could talk to me after the session, you know. Well, geotargeting, we can't do geotargeting yet. We're going to hope to roll it out in about 3 months, though. But we do have the plumbing in place with our some of the new stuff that we've just launched to do that.
And are you guys building your own stuff, or are you licensing third-party software?
It's third-party.
In our case, we have the infrastructure ability to do that with a minimal amount of work. It's just a question of taking it the last 10 yards, and there hasn't been a demand.
Is yours proprietary?
Yeah.
You guys? We're kind of a hybrid. We have a bunch of proprietary stuff that links into traditional ad networks or ad serving infrastructure.
So you guys brought, Nabil Hayat from Conduit Labs, you guys brought up this kind of like holy grail between curatorial music and unicasting, and it seems to me that the long tail of something halfway in between the two that happens to be live is something like Live 365, and I'm curious why, I don't know, you know, you asked a very cogent question, which is, are they even still around? And I'm curious why live internet radio and the long tail really hasn't really come to fruition. It hasn't been mainstream.
Well, I mean, 60 million Americans listen to internet radio. I mean, I know that it's sort of, well, I think my perception of it when we started Pandora was just sort of this terrible thing. But the reality is it's kind of a sleeper hit. I mean, you know, outside of the sort of, you know, music, you know, intelligentsia, internet radio is huge.
My flip answer would be people don't listen to internet radio more because they're too busy stealing music.
Yeah. But I meant specifically not just internet radio in general. I'm sure all you guys are trying to grow the market, but I'm talking about specifically curated internet radio. I'm the live internet radio. Me, I've got a stream. I'm trying to stream shit for you guys to listen to, and no one does it anymore.
Sure. And if you aggregate all that stuff together, the aggregation of all of that content is far bigger than Pandora. So, you know, that is what internet radio is.
I mean, look, there's 1,700 music blogs too, but most people only go to the top 10 if you look at the numbers on Alexa or whatever. I think for small independents, marketing yourself on the web is not an easy thing. There's a lot of stuff out there. People's time gets sucked up by lots of things. And, you know, I find myself, whereas in the early days of the internet, I used to go to lots of sites for the novelty of it. Now I go to, like, thenewyorktimes.com. My world's gotten smaller instead of larger.
I think the long tail, by definition, means that it's not really going to get into the mainstream, right? Because you're really out there. And, I mean...
What's happened with Live 365 is that what's happened with Live 365 is that 2 years ago they went to a model where the service is designed to push you to subscription. So they gave up on an advertising supported service. So listening to Live 365 without paying for a subscription means hearing them talk about how great subscription is every other song. And so the reality is, at least based on my, I don't work there, but my limited understanding of what they're trying to do is, they don't want you to listen ad-supported, they want you to become a subscriber. And the subscription market is tiny, 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 tiny compared to the ad-supported free market. So they're getting smaller in pursuit of having a profitable business in the immediate term.
All right, well, thanks, everybody. Let's give a round of applause for our panelists.